European observers. Even before the shift in Perso-European interests, from the anti-Ottoman alliance to commercial competition, Persia had become a space to be experienced by Europeans and non-Europeans through adventure, imagination, and nostalgia. Yet it was only occasionally understood on its own terms. The age of printing generated a new European readership, as well as a new popular scholarship, curious to know the world through travel accounts and geographical literature. What Persia offered to the Italian, French, English, Spanish, and German writers and readers, along with the unique marvels of India, China, and Japan, and the might of the Ottoman Empire, was not simply the pomp and circumstance of the Safavid court, its wealth, and its trade. Europeans traced the material evidence of Persia's ancient past and its place in the biblical and Greco-Roman experience. Persian literary and historical texts were translated and appreciated, and Persian culture, institutions, and lifestyle observed and sometimes imitated. Some of the earliest Orientalist representations of the East were shaped by images of the Safavid court, culture, and society. After the removal of the Portuguese from Hormuz, one of the first travellers who returned to Europe through India in 1623, aboard an English ship, was the Roman nobleman Pietro della Valle. A talented observer, in a series of long dispatches, he chronicled his six-year stay in Iran, his personal encounters with Shah Abbas, and his experiences with the Persian people. Della Valle's letters, published in the following decades and later abridged and translated, provided a wealth of information about Safavid Iran through the eye of an often sympathetic, though occasionally smug, observer, an account interwoven with his own life story of passion and panache. He was a valuable source of information to the Shah, and he briefed him about European kings and nobility, alliances and rivalries, social mores and lifestyle. Abbas probably relied on sources such as Della Valle to define and readjust his course, although it is hard to see as a whole any specific evidence of European inspiration. Shortly after Abbas's time, a German scholar and Persian interpreter, Adam Olearius, was sent on a mission by Frederick III, Duke of Holstein, to establish commercial relations with Safavid Iran. Olearius arrived in Isfahan in 1637 via the northern route through Muscovy. The account of his travels to Russia and Persia, first published in 1647, is one of several detailed 17th-century narratives that helped introduce Safavid Iran to European audiences beyond the rampant stereotypes of the exotic Orient. His description of Isfahan included useful data on urban life, the court of Shah Safi, Abbas's successor, the Armenians and their quarter, the tea and coffee houses, gardens, buildings and architecture, and everyday lives of ordinary people. Beyond Isfahan, he also made realistic observations of other towns and villages in the Safavid domain. As a man of letters, Olearius's 1654 translation into German of Sa'adi's Golestan was among the earliest Persian classics to appear in a European language. A quarter of a century after Olearius, when the French Huguenot merchant of precious stones and luxury goods, Jean Chardin, first visited Iran in 1666, the Iranian knowledge of Europe and Europeans was somewhat more accurate. His multi-volume account in French, the best known in European languages about 17th-century Iran, was first published in London in 1686 and revised several times. Chardin presented the changing Safavid society of the post-Abbas era as multi-ethnic and urbane, with an elite culture of serenity and pleasure and languishing socio-religious institutions. Far more than any other account in the vast and diverse travel literature on Safavid Iran, Chardin's was widely read both in his own time and in later years. Almost encyclopedic in approach, he observed, collected, and commented on a variety of topics, from land and ecology to government, religion, literature, history, and everyday life. In due course, the representation that he formulated was influential in the 18th-century European imagination of Persia. Montesquieu's Lettres Persanes relied in part on both Olearius and Chardin and the format of their journals to portray an imaginary Persian observer of French society. In doing so, he wraps his critique of French despotism in a Persian cloak and transposed Louis XIV with an unnamed Persian Shah. Voltaire, Rousseau, and Gibbon, among others, read Chardin intentionally and located his Iran in their philosophical and historical discourses, often with grudging respect. Later travellers to Iran, especially in the 19th century, dabbled in Chardin's themes and ruminated on his cultural biases, often with a stronger sense of cultural superiority. Despite his many factual errors, Chardin was an observer with a degree of understanding of the culture and society he was fascinated with. His knowledge of Safavid domains brought him the reputation of being the prototypical Iran expert who advised, at different times in his career, the English and the Dutch East India Companies. Whether through travellers or through other means, Shah Abbas's European commercial enterprise and political alliances brought mixed results. His hope for an anti-Ottoman pact with Europe never really paid off, for reasons beyond his technological and diplomatic control. Toward the end of Abbas's reign, both the Safavids and the Ottomans were realistic enough to appreciate the cautious entente that had emerged between the two powers. Yet, contacts with Europe made Iranians realize that they were not alone facing the Ottoman threat. Abbas was astute enough to realize that the only way the Ottoman geographical barrier could be successfully crossed was through European diplomacy and trade. To the Iranians, moreover, European visitors offered the earliest encounters with a dynamic and complex Europe, prototypes of the Farangi other, who were curious, resourceful, and shrewd. A corollary to the new European trade, European travellers revealed before the Persian eye a face of modernity that was about to engage and later threaten their world. Confines of the Safavid horizon. None of the emissaries of the Safavid era, with the exception of Don Juan of Persia, left behind accounts of his visits to the European courts. The era of Abbas I and his immediate successors remained largely insular, despite a remarkable fluorescence in speculative thought and artistic creativity. If there was an awareness of Europe, even among the intellectual elite, so far as we know, it was confined to trade and merchandise, to kingdoms and armies, to a few Jesuit missionaries and Christian monks, and to soldiers of fortune. There were also Farangi-style caps, matchlocks, and other European or Europeanized paraphernalia in Persian paintings, textiles, and architecture of the period. European-style scenery also appeared in late Safavid paintings. It is hard to believe that in cosmopolitan Isfahan of the time, some debate and exchange of information about intellectual and scientific issues would not have taken place among the numerous European visitors, members of trade missions, and missionaries, and the members of the Divan or scholars who frequented the Safavid court. Abbas's curiosity about everything European, including the Europeans themselves, must have been contagious. Yet precious little was ever written about Europe by Safavid authors beyond passing geographical references, mostly based on classical Islamic texts rather than on fresh learning and observation. There is little internal evidence in the works of the philosophers and theologians of the period, even the literati and the historians, to suggest a tangible intellectual interplay. Early modern European thinkers and their scientific discoveries remained unknown to the Safavids, even as late as early 19th century. Despite being produced with renewed vigour, works of Safavid astronomy, mathematics, and sciences ignored crucial questions of modern science, and Iranians seemed to be unaware of the European discourses in method and human individuality. If the Safavids were aware, it did not surface in their body of common knowledge. Europeans, despite their notable presence, were infidels so far as the formal scholarship was concerned. Their customs and accomplishments could be neither the subject of Muslim curiosity nor imitated. Fear of being branded as heretical for following the ways of the infidels dissuaded the curious from travelling abroad or learning European languages. Those who did remained anonymous or left no record for posterity. Even imagining Europe seems to have been a perilous venture, since no book of marvel of any significance has yet surfaced from this period. By the 17th century, the discovery of the New World was known, but to the few who heard about it from the Portuguese and the English, including Abbas himself. To them, it was no more than an exotic land, rich in gold and silver, but also full of savages, as Native Americans were portrayed in European woodcuts and other representations. Only very late in the 18th century, a more accurate picture of the Americas began to emerge in the Indo-Persian works of geography produced in early colonial India. China had largely disappeared from the Safavid horizon, despite the long history of cultural and commercial exchange. Except for precious commodities, such as porcelain and spices, coming through the Indian Ocean route, and Persian porcelain going to China along the same route, there was little direct contact between the two civilizations on the ancient overland Silk Road. The Chinese-style figures that Persian artists portrayed in their paintings were about the only memory still alive of that rich past. A certain Sayyid Ali Akbar Khatai, an emissary from Bukhara, who travelled to northern China and left behind a fascinating account in Persian, titled Khatai Name, the Book of Cathay, was as foreign to the Chinese as they were to him. Perhaps himself a Persian renegade, in 1516 he dedicated his book to the Ottoman Sultan Selim I. It was soon translated to Ottoman Turkish. His description of the Chinese court ceremonies, cities, everyday life, medicine, judicial system, and prisons. He was detained for about a month because a member of his retinue was engaged in a brawl with a group of Tibetans, were presumably all new to his audiences, since his account is devoid of any reference to an earlier body of literature about China. 18th-century translations in Persian of the life of the famous Jesuit in 16th-century China, Matteo Ricci, done by an Iranian exile in the Mughal Empire, remained unknown to the Safavid reader. Likewise, Japan resonated in the mind of the Safavids as nothing more than the distant and exotic islands of Wog Varg, of the classical Islamic books of marvels. Southeast Asia, however, was better known to the Persians, thanks to communities of Indo-Persian merchants who had settled in Indonesia, Burma, and Siam since the 15th century. They brought with them to these lands their own brand of eclectic Islam and trade practices. The secretary to a Safavid embassy to the court of the King Narai, reigned 1656 to 1688, of Siam, or Thailand, in 1685, left behind a fascinating account of the government and the people of that country. Safineya Salemani, the Ship of Solomon, named after the Safavid ruler Shah Soleiman, 1666 to 1694, sheds light on the Persian and Japanese merchants, advisers, and mercenaries to the King of Siam, who defied the influence of the native mandarins and European commercial and political rivals. Along the way to Siam, the author Muhammad Ibrahim ibn Muhammad Rabi, who served as secretary of the mission, offered valuable accounts of the English in India and their customs and manners. Even more than it had in medieval Islamic times, Hindustan loomed large in the Iranian mind as the quintessential exotic place. It was also a profitable trade route, especially since the ships of the English and French East India Companies began to frequent the Persian Gulf with greater regularity. India became more accessible and a place of refuge for those in search of fame and fortune, or an escape from religious and political persecution. Yet before the latter part of the 18th century, Persian systematic descriptions of Hindustan were rare. The scant interest among Shi'i scholars toward the outside world was also obfuscated because of Christian-Muslim controversies. Predictably, among Shi'i scholars, there was little interest in non-believers and their societies and cultures, and polemical literature of the period conveyed little but doctrinal debates. Likewise, Christian polemics produced by Europeans generally were uninterested in Safavid society and culture. Heeding the Shah's request, Zayn al-Abidin Alavi, for instance, a learned jurist descended from a Jabali Amil family, wrote a number of Persian refutations in response to Portuguese Jesuit missionaries based in Goa on the western coast of India. Alavi's apologias were largely based on classical accounts, although they showed some awareness of the current schisms within Christendom, despite the Jesuits' facade of unanimity. His best-known book, written in 1622, shortly before the Safavids' joint operation with the English East India Company against the Portuguese, conveyed Abbas's political agenda. Commissioning Alavi to write a refutation was no less transparent than Portuguese support for their missionaries. His wish was no doubt aligned with the duty of the ulama to preserve the seed of Islam from disbelief. Hence, it appeared only logical to any mainstream scholar of the time to refute and reject Jesuits and their European patrons. The advantage of the Portuguese Jesuits over their Shi'i respondents, of course, was more technological than theological. Their Christian literature was the first to be printed in Persian and distributed in India and Iran, while the Muslim responses inscribed in manuscripts never left the royal or elite libraries. The Jesuit print literature in Persian, to which Alavi's apologias were directed, was originally produced for Mughal India, but also was distributed in Iran, possibly through a network of Catholic missionaries active mostly among the Armenians of Isfahan. In addition to the Jesuits, throughout the 17th century, Carmelites, Franciscans, Augustinians, and Capuchins built and maintained monasteries and churches in Isfahan with the approval of the Safavid government. Relying on Abbas's pro-Christian affinities, missionaries nevertheless were no more than benign tokens of European presence. They were unable to convert the Muslim public to their message of faith, let alone spread the secular message of early modern Europe. One of the earliest books to appear in print in Persian, the Dastane Masih, Historia Christi Persice, was a bilingual Persian-Latin account of the life of Jesus, compiled by the well-known Jesuit missionary Jerónimo Javier. Javier offered a single narrative of Christ's story, palatable to Muslim readers who were unaccustomed to the notion of four Gospels, in contrast to their own single Quran scripture. Despite Javier's earnest effort, the Persian prose of Dastane Masih proved somewhat coarse and unreadable, even though he apparently had benefited from the help of Persian-speaking converts in India. As with much missionary literature, this early specimen was not successful in Iran in winning over new converts from among the Muslims. It is not unlikely, however, that it attracted learned readers, for it was offering an alternative narrative of Jesus to that of the familiar Quranic and Muslim apocryphal literature. Although Persian readers were familiar with much earlier translations of the Gospels, the printed rendering had a very different effect. The print revolution gave Europe enormous leverage over non-Western cultures in making available to the literate European public a wide range of material. Such popularization of knowledge and the subsequent breakdown of the elite's monopoly over texts and learning did not happen in the Middle East before the late 18th century. The predominant medium for public knowledge remained in manuscript form, and more so in oral form. Knowledge was transmitted through elite channels, and incentives for literacy were limited to a madrasa education and bureaucracy of the divan. Although a small Armenian printing house with Armenian typeface did exist in New Julfa at the time, the idea of printing seems not to have impressed Iranians for a long time. Disinterest in the printed word, however, was less of a setback with regard to theological disputes. As Imami Shi'i dogma solidified, channels for relaying the state's religious ideology to the public came under greater control of clerical establishment. The state-sponsored propagandists, who urged people in the street to recite their rhymed cursing of the early caliphs, now were supplemented in the mosque by melodic readers of the tragedies of Karbala, and by preachers who instructed them to implement Shi'i devotional rituals and abide by the teachings of the jurists. Popular associations of the Sufis in their convents, as well as the gatherings of the wandering Galandars, were banned. Likewise, the reading of the Shahnameh in coffeehouses, and in the Zurhanes, houses of strength, was discouraged and generally disapproved by the jurists. Noctavi, Millennial Revival. Practicing Sufi orders were especially the target of persecution, for jurists and the state viewed them as undesirable, if not a dangerous hotbed of nonconformity and even heresy. Closure of the Safavid frontiers and the hostility of their Sunni neighbours, moreover, restricted the movement of the dervishes, who were in the habit of travelling far and wide across the Islamic world. They were an important alternative source of information for ordinary people in towns and villages. The Galandars, as they were generally known, were itinerant dervishes who wore rags and animal skins. They were tattooed, had piercings and burn marks, exhibited non-conformist behaviour, often smoked hashish, and maintained a lax lifestyle. Loosely organised, their convents, known as langars, stretching throughout the Persianate world and beyond, from Bukhara to Kashmir to Baghdad and the Balkans, were home to unconventionalities, sexual, social, political, and at times messianic. Their lifestyle and utterances, which adhered to popularized monism and ideas of reincarnation and transmigration, often in the form of recited poetry, as well as their tales of remote lands and strange people that they narrated to their street audiences, were frowned upon by the ulama, who saw dervishes as competition for preaching in the mosques. As the Safavid establishment turned against the Sufis, the thrust of the anti-dogmatic policy was first borne by the Noctavis at the turn of the Islamic millennium, AH 1000, or 1591 to 1592 CE. The revived Noctavi, literally pointist, movement, upheld the memory of Mahmud of Pasighan in Gilan province, a Persian prophet who had lived two centuries earlier. His Kabbalistic creed, with a mystic materialistic bent and an apocalyptic message, found new appeal in the Safavid era in reaction to both the Gezil Bash hegemony and greater jurist indoctrination of the Safavid public. In its origins, Noctaviism was the most cerebral and systematic manifestation of the greater Kalandari movement of the late Islamic Middle Ages. The Safavid sources that disparagingly labelled them as heretics indeed had a point. For Noctavis, earth was the most vital of the four elements and was considered the origin of man, whom they identified as the prophet Adam. Humankind's progression in time from one point to the next, they believed, went through successive millennial cycles that had been initiated by the chain of Abrahamic prophets. The religion of Islam, initiated by Muhammad, the prophet of the Arabs, the Noctavis upheld, was to be abrogated at the end of the Islamic millennium, and a new Persian cycle, Dore Ajam, would commence, as foretold by Mahmud of Pasighan. The Noctavis' conscious attempt to break away from the dominant religion of the time was a rare phenomenon in Islamic history. The Persian cycle of material progression in the Noctavis' belief system promised earthly humans freedom from the heavens through a quasi-rationalist cosmology. The point theory, after which the movement was named, viewed the universe as a text consisting of letters, with each letter consisting of points. In its progression through time, the primal point was considered the motivating force behind stages of human perfection. This sense of historical progression stood in contrast to the veneration of the past in normative Islam, especially the prophetic past, so widely celebrated in the study of the theology of the Safavid period and by traditionalist scholars, whose prime focus was the study of hadith, the reports on the words and the deeds of the Prophet of Islam and the Shi'i imams. The alternative convents of the Noctavis in the Safavid period, so far as the sources inform us, were more about music, wine, appreciation of nature, good food, and intellectual discourse than formalities of the Sharia. A love of Persian literature was combined with aversion toward jurists and what they stood for. These convents were apparently attractive to the general public, but also frequented by the urban elite, and later they may have been associated with tea and coffee houses as they became prevalent in Isfahan and elsewhere. In his nocturnal outings around Ghazvin in disguise, Abbas for a while attended the convent of the Noctavi leader, Darvish Khosrow, who informed the Shah about Noctavi beliefs and educated him in the art of good living, while no doubt warning him about the impending upheaval at the turn of the Islamic millennium. We may assume that it was the growing popularity of the Noctavis and their anti-jurist and even anti-state ideas which turned the Shah against them. The Noctavis were persecuted under Tahmasp, but it was Abbas's millennial anxieties that persuaded him to eradicate the agnostic heretics. Following his astrologer's advice, and under the pretext of avoiding the ominous celestial conjunction in March 1592, corresponding to year 1000 of the Hijra calendar, he temporarily abdicated, placing a Noctavi dervish on the throne in his stead. This, no doubt, was a symbolic move, perhaps mimicking a Nowruz ritual of Carnival King, Mire Nowruzi, which in effect aimed to bring about the Noctavi promise of a new era. In a few days, however, once the supposed ominous millennial conjunction was over, the Shah promptly ordered the execution of the deceived Dervish king. In a concerted move, he subsequently went about destroying the Noctavi rural and urban network and killing the movement's intellectual and community leaders on charges of heresy and treason. They had been accused of preparing for a revolutionary overthrow of the Safavid state, and even of collaborating with foreign powers. Their correspondence with Abul Fazle Alami, died 1602, the celebrated minister to Emperor Akbar, reigned 1556 to 1605, the Mughal ruler of India, reportedly proved the existence of a network and such a plot. Even if these charges were fabricated to counter the Noctavi's popularity, by adding an anti-state twist to their proven anti-clericalism, there was reality in Alami's affinity with the Noctavis and other Iranian nonconformists. In the following decades, Noctavi sympathizers took refuge in the Mughal Empire, part of an exodus of Sufis, writers, poets, and artists who left behind the suffocating dogmatic world of the late Safavid era for the prosperity and tolerance of the Mughal court. We can detect the Noctavi's influence in particular on Alami's doctrine of universal conciliation, Sol Hek Kol, perhaps among the greatest intellectual achievements of the Mughal era, and the foundation of Akbar's royal cult, known as the Divine Creed, Dine-e Elahi. Contrary to the Ottoman and Safavid sponsorship of the Sunni and Shi'i creeds, universal conciliation envisioned the state as the promoter and guarantor of religious diversity. The Mughal millennial king eventually stopped enforcing all predominant symbols of Islam, such as the call to prayer and observation of the fast in Ramadan, in favor of his millennial Divan creed. The collapse of the Noctavi movement in Iran, by contrast, signaled the Safavids' favoring of the Shi'i Orthodox establishment at the expense of any alternative. The Noctavi thought thus could have only indirectly influenced the Safavid environment. It is not inconceivable to think that philosophy of the school of Isfahan, and even Abbas's patronage of it, or his new perception of urban spaces, with an element of leisure incorporated into it, were inspired by the Noctavi thought. Beyond Noctavis, throughout the 17th century, other non-Sharia trends, such as the Sufi orders, were systematically banned, forced underground, or driven into exile. Even the Safavi order, the wellspring of the ruling dynasty, was allowed to dry out in all but name, long after the Gezilbash Sufis had bartered their messianic zeal for lucrative state offices. Those who remained associated with the declining order, we are told, served in menial jobs in the Safavid court as the Safavids moved closer to the correct 12-heir Shi'ism of the jurists. The latter had helped legitimize the state as a sacred institution and proved essential to countering domestic dissent and external influences. The more the Ottoman and Uzbek states turned to Sunni orthodoxy, the more the Safavids became dogmatic Shi'is, and so closing the geopolitical horizons of Iranian territory and society. Wisdom of Transcendence. The rise of urban piety did not entirely decimate the Safavid's potential for speculative thought. Although similar to the Ottoman post-conquest world, the shift in the Safavid state's ideology allowed conservative jurists to articulate an ethos of pious legalism through law, ritual, and sacred myth. The Safavid age also nurtured a new generation of thinkers akin to mystical and philosophical thought, even at times engaging in proto-modern themes that otherwise were entertained only by antinomian trends outside the confines of normative Islam. The founders of the emerging Safavid schools of theology and philosophy were often men of religious learning. In exchange for state patronage, they generated a politically mute and harmless hybrid of philosophy, theology, and mysticism beneficial to the state's homogenizing agenda. The School of Isfahan, as it came to be known in modern times, offered an innocuous alternative to such trends as Noctavism, indigenous to the Iranian environment. This school of thought's affinity to the Safavid court, and the clerical background of those who were engaged in it, made the new theosophical interest, at least in the early stages, a safe enterprise. Yet philosophical discourse, even when disguised as theosophy, still could not escape the jurists' condemnations. They were labelled undesirable and even heretical. The so-called school of Isfahan was heir to a speculative tradition that, though by and large had been abandoned in the rest of the Islamic world, it had survived and even thrived in Iran. Whether in the form of the peripatetic philosophy of Ibn Sina, Avicenna, with strong Neoplatonic overtones, or more often the Illumination School, Eshrag, of Shahab ad-Din Sohrabardi, died 1191, Iranians since the early Islamic era had continued to engage in philosophical discourse. Shi'ism also utilized the rationalistic premises of the Mu'tazilit movement of the early Islamic era to buttress its alternative theology. A tamed scholastic philosophical tradition was thus preserved in the Shi'i curriculum, first among the Ismaili thinkers, with emphasis on rationalized religious thought, Khairad, and later through works of a towering scholar of the 13th century, Nasir ad-Din Tusi. In the same vein, the school of Isfahan never stopped reconciling a rarefied version of Islamic dogma with a crippled rendition of rational thought, a tedious project, as it turned out, and one of grand scale. Yet such an undertaking could not entirely abandon such inherent themes in the Iranian milieu as, for example, Muhammad ibn Zakariya Razi's adherence to the ancient Iranian idea of eternal time, Dar, and Sohrabardi's return to a largely imaginary reconstruction of Zoroastrian wisdom. Residues of Persian agnosticism did survive. On the surface, Safavid Iran seemed the least favourable climate for the growth of such speculative thought. Even redefining philosophy, falsafa, in the guise of hechmat, Gnostic wisdom, did not alleviate the pressure on teachers of theosophy and their small circle of students, who displayed every sign of religious conformity so as to avoid charges of heresy. Yet the growth of speculative thought in the 17th century can be viewed as part of a greater assimilation process within Shi'ism. The complexities of urban Persian high culture attracted Arab jurists and Turkish gezilbash toward such activities as poetry, history, philosophy, and scientific experimentation, while hardly ever inspiring them to learn something about the world beyond their Shi'i domain, except perhaps a cursory interest in Indian thought. One of the most successful figures of the period moulded into this Persian caste is the celebrated Baha'uddin Ameli, 1547-1621, also known by his nom de plume, Sheikh Baha'i. A theologian, jurist, mathematician, grammarian, poet, and moralist, his universalistic pursuits might be compared, for example, to Erasmus of Rotterdam, his near contemporary. An émigré from a family of jurists from Jabal Yamil, the young Baha'uddin first learned Persian at the age of 10 when he was a novice in a Shiraz madrasa. He perfected it to such a degree that he was able to compose prose and poetry in his acquired language. He rose to prominence at a relatively young age and briefly became the Sheikh al-Islam of Isfahan, the highest judicial post in the land, in part because of his proper lineage and powerful connections, but also because of his sound scholarship and refined Persian. As an urban designer, Baha'i was credited with devising a master plan for the new city of Isfahan. He reportedly also engineered Zendarud's irrigation network for the city and its environs, as well as his own ingenious design for increasing that river's water flow by diverting water from the Bakhtiardi Highlands in Kuranga, in the Zagros mountain range, more than 100 miles northwest of Isfahan. His interest in mathematics, physics, and alchemy generated a number of living legends about him and the buildings associated with his name. In greater part, however, Sheikh Baha'i succeeded because he symbolized a compassionate side of Shi'ism, supportive of the jurists, but also popular among the lay people. His Jami' Abbasi, the Abbasian Compendium, a manual of the Shi'i jurisprudence in Persian, contained essential Shi'i devotional, contractual, and penal laws and rituals. Commissioned by the Shah, as the title suggests, this was the closest Safavid Iran would come to codifying the Sharia with a well-organized, user-friendly format and easy style, later to be completed by a student of Sheikh Baha'i. Its vast popularity up to the 20th century may be explained by its success in rescuing Shi'i law from the tedious elaborations and digressions in jurists' texts and turning it into a usable manual for ordinary people. This and other state-sponsored summaries of Shi'i traditions and devotional acts served to deepen the roots of the state creed in a population still uncertain about its Shi'i loyalty. Also important for the shaping of a formal creed, Sheikh Baha'i contributed to Shi'i madrasa education through works of law, hadith, and Arabic grammar, as well as his promotion of mathematics and Ptolemaic astronomy. It is difficult to detect much originality in his scholarly output, but he and the ethnically diverse students under him translated, commented on, and popularized Shi'i works of earlier times. At least three of Sheikh Baha'i's own works on the hadith, Arab syntax, and mathematics remained part of the Shi'i scholastic curriculum up to the 20th century. His Persian didactic and lyrical poetry, by contrast, promoted individualistic mystical experience. The so-called Irfani approach to religion employed Sufi terminology and discourse, while also portraying Sufis as deceptive and heretical, presumably because of their emphasis on mystical ecstasy through music and dance. In a didactic fable, Mush var Gobeh, Mouse and Cat, after Obeid Zakani's 14th century satire, Sheikh Baha'i lampoons the Sufis, characterized as the shrewd mouse, and sharply attacks their alleged hypocrisy and superstition. The Sufis' opponent, however, is a jurist characterized as a wise and charitable cat who is enlightened by the true path of Sharia. He is often addressed in the story with the royal epithet Shahryar, minor king or princely ruler. At the end of a long and dreary dialogue, with many cautionary tales about Sufi trickery, the impatient cat devours the mouse, reflecting the unabashed wish, no doubt, of the jurists to see the Sufis eradicated and for the Fabis to acquire their majestic peak. It is hard not to see why the greatest representative of the school of Isfahan, Sadr ed-Din Shirazi, better known as Mullah Sadra, 1572-1641, invested so much intellectual energy to make his theosophy appear theologically correct. His eclectic philosophy was informed by a remarkably wide range of sources: the peripatetic and Neoplatonic philosophies, the intuitive philosophy of Sohrawardi, and the theoretical mysticism of Ibn al-Arabi. Yet his synthesis bore the stigma of centuries of arduous adjustments to the demands of Islamic piety, a feature that Mullah Sadra managed to stamp on the future course of philosophical inquiry in Iran and the Persianate world. With its remarkable breadth and complexity, his philosophy could survive the onslaught of the jurists and remain part of the Shi'i madrasa curriculum only if it was wrapped in this pious clothing. Its original and revolutionary potential, however, was lost to the conventionality and conservatism of his students and commentators. Born to an affluent family of notables from Shiraz, he was not of ethnic Arab descent, as were his teachers, Sheikh Baha'i and Mir Muhammad Bagher Astarabadi, better known as Mir Damad, or Mir Damad, died 1632. He studied theology with the former and philosophy with the latter, but after a while he broke away from the Isfahan circle and settled in Chahak, a village 20 miles south of Qom, which later in the 17th century would become the seat of the Nizari Ismaili Imam. He led a life of solitude and meditation for many years in this village, where his visionary experiences, as he later retold, helped him see the inadequacy of the scholastic reasoning that plagued Islamic philosophy. The existential path that he explored to complement his Avicennian approach to philosophy, however, did not prevent Mullah Sadra from re-examining at length in his numerous works the familiar gamut of arcane philosophical topics: being versus quiddity, substance versus contingence, and pre-existence versus accidental. Reinventing the philosophical wheel, unexciting though it was, seemed necessary in order for Mullah Sadra to lay a theologically correct grounding for his more original contributions. He returned to Shiraz in 1612 from his retreat with the confidence of a philosopher-prophet whose potentially revolutionary thought would never have been tolerated in the ulama-dominated climate of Isfahan. In his hometown, he pondered, taught, and wrote relatively unharassed under the protection of the powerful governor of Fars, the aforementioned Allah Verdi Khan, the Armenian convert from the Golam origin. The magnificent madrasa built by Allah Verdi, today known as Madrasa-e Khan, evidently in honor of Mullah Sadra, showed his enthusiasm for speculative thought. Mullah Sadra's theory of movement of the substance, Harakah Johariya, often translated as transubstantiation, arguably his most significant philosophical contribution, was a novel departure. His theory of substantial movement in part modified the influential Sufi monistic theory of the unity of being, Wahdata Wujud. The belief in the essential origin of all beings, celestial and terrestrial, and their ultimate union, had long been opposed by conservative jurists and theologians. Mullah Sadra further advanced the idea of unity of being by arguing that in the substance of all things created, of which humanity holds the highest rank, there is an innate cosmic dynamism without which all things cease to exist. This elemental movement transforms the quality of all things at all times from one state to another, without their substance ever changing. As the created being separates itself from its divine origin, in its downward journey toward matter, it acquires material contingents, making the world as we see and experience it. The same intrinsic dynamism in an upward movement then transforms the substance of material things until ultimately they reach their original celestial state. Different from similar circular models articulated by Mullah Sadra's predecessors, here progression in time was considered emblematic of the substance of things rather than a primal initiative of divine origin. In other words, all beings, including humanity, carry the seeds of progression in their journey to perfection. The movement of the human substance from its original spiritual state to its full realization in this world, and then its reverting back to its origin, completes a full circle. Such a journey, in Mullah Sadra's view, corresponds to the Islamic doctrine of the beginning and the end in the Quran and the Hadith. In its radical rendition, however, agency was assigned to the very movement of essence in time rather than to the divine initiator, a proto-modern system, perhaps, that aimed to disengage from the divine and focus on the profane. Mullah Sadra's theory of movement acquired an eschatological dimension as it attempted to answer the dilemma of corporeal resurrection in Islam, that is, that the dead shall rise on the day of judgment in their corporal frame. Here we see a reflection, perhaps, of the millennial hopes and anxieties of his time. As a philosopher who viewed himself as the guardian, Vali, in the center of the universe he posited, Mullah Sadra seemed to view transcendental wisdom, as he called his philosophy, as a visionary complement to prophetic revelation. In Shi'ism, this was during the absence, or occultation, of the Imam of the age, the Mahdi. The eschatological dimension gave Mullah Sadra's philosophy a sense of temporal urgency, even when safely wrapped in the garb of a theological debate and adorned with Quranic verses and Shi'i traditions. The apocalyptic vision of the end, of the rising of the corporeal essence, a chief preoccupation of Mullah Sadra, anticipated a new era for humanity as it began its upward trajectory toward perfect intelligence. This stage is the final of the four journeys, Asfar, which he experienced by his own intuition and articulated into a systematic philosophical system in his magnum opus, known as Asfar il-Arba'a, completed in 1628. Here, the resemblance to the Noctavi doctrine of mankind as the primal point of progression in time may not be a mere coincidence, nor are Mullah Sadra's four stages in the existential journey toward perfection unlike the four-sided essential square in the Noctavi theory of Mahmud Pasikhani. Malah Sadra's eschatological vision, a lifetime preoccupation, which in the first place had caused his excommunication, takfir, by the jurists, and his subsequent departure from Isfahan, should be viewed as a potential breakthrough from the Sharia-dominated view of his contemporaries. The theory of essential movement, it may be argued, had the potential to transform and innovate Safavid thought. As was his European near-contemporary Baruch Spinoza, who lived a generation later and shared remarkable similarities with Malah Sadra, especially in holding substance as a continuity of God in nature, the Persian philosopher experienced much harassment. Like the German philosopher Friedrich Hegel, whom Malah Sadra preceded by more than a century, the idea of the development of the spirit through time aimed to make human agency the center of the historical unfolding of the absolute. Yet Malah Sadra almost never explicitly distanced himself from the cyclical notion of descent and ascent of the soul. His essentially Platonic notion of transcendental wisdom, though evolving with time, still remained loyal to the concept of veloyat, the sacred agency entrusted by God in humankind. He contemplated the human intellect, both rational and intuitive, in the context of veloyat, a complex Sufi-Shi'i notion pertaining to guardianship, governance, or authority, and one with legal, mystical, and political connotations. Power of traditions. By the late 17th century, the promising intellectual momentum seems to have come to its end. Most evident in this respect was the late Safavid scholar's engagement with the study of hadith, traditions, and akhbar, reports, related from the Prophet and the Shi'i imams, a pedantic preoccupation that clearly contrasted with the speculative thinking of earlier generations. These traditions, so far as their validity was concerned, enjoyed a degree of sanction second only to the word of the Quran. Yet the methodology used among Shi'i scholars to authenticate such reports remained fairly lax. This was especially true among scholars known as Akhbaris, who relied on all traditions as well as copious reports transmitted through a single reporter. In the formative centuries of Shi'ism, this collection of hadiths resulted in a huge increase in suspect or fabricated reports being admitted to the hadith's corpus, often contrary to the rudiments of authenticating of the hadith. The range of contradictory and anachronistic reports in the Safavid hadith collections were therefore so wide and so obvious that one cannot but conclude that the growth of Akhbarism as a school was an effort to streamline this corpus. At least initially, Akhbarism functioned as a liberating strategy to sanction social habits and cultural norms, as had been done for many centuries, and to sanctify mystical and esoteric traits present in Iranian Islam. Yet this double-edged sword of reliance on the hadith also could have worked against philosophy, theoretical Sufism, and other nonconformist trends. No better example in this regard can be found than that of Malah Muhammad Baqir Majlisi, 1627-1698, perhaps the most influential religious scholar of Shi'ism before the 20th century. His career as Sheikh al-Islam and holder of the office Malah Bashi, chief royal cleric, presiding for more than a decade over all the religious affairs of the late Safavid Empire, and his prolific scholarly and popular writings, left its mark on the Shi'i landscape. His conservative brand of scholastic Shi'ism further weakened the remnants of free thinking in the Iranian milieu and contributed to the spirit of social intolerance of the late Safavid era. Born to a family of scholars of Arab and Persian descent, Majlisi's father was a student of Malah Sadra and a noted scholar and mystic. Muhammad Baqir, who had studied philosophy earlier in life, however, focused on the study of hadith. His lifetime preoccupation resulted in an encyclopedic collection in Arabic of Shi'i hadith in 26 volumes titled Bihar al-Anwar, Oceans of Luminescence. Applying a new arrangement by subject and presiding over a team of assistants for 3 decades, he collected and classified Shi'i traditions and commented on them. The topics ranged from creation to manifestation of the 12th Imam, eschatology, ethics, and devotional acts. Though himself closer to the Akhbaris, his endeavor laid the foundation for the late 18th century revival of the doctrine of Ijtihad. Majlisi's equally influential Persian works, popular renderings of the Bihar volumes, on subjects such as devotional acts, ethics, and Shi'i sacred history, were instrumental in Iran's becoming a truly Shi'i nation. By writing about the Prophet and the Imams in an easily accessible Persian style, Majlisi, like Sheikh Baha'i before him, offered ordinary people an appealing narrative, rich in emotions, hope, and suffering. Not only the literate public, perhaps no more than 5% of the population, could read his works. More effectively, his narratives, such as Jalal al-Ayun, Sparkler of the Eyes, 1697, on the suffering of the Shi'i Imams, recited from the pulpit of the mosques and commemorated through mourning processions during the holy month of Muharram. The manual Zad al-Ma'ad, Provisions for the Day of Return, a set of detailed instructions on Shi'i prayers, fasting, and other devotional acts, was commissioned in 1695 by the last of the Safavids, the pious Shah Sultan Hussein, reigned 1694 to 1722. It soon became one of the most widely read Persian religious texts of all time, with at least 32 editions printed between 1828 and 1958. Majlisi's equally popular Hilyat al-Matagin, The Cloak for the Pious, which elevates Shi'ism to a new ritualistic plane, contains invocations and thaumaturgic instructions for every human activity: clothing, eating, drinking, bathing and personal hygiene, scatology, sexual intercourse, child-rearing, education, marital affairs, parental relations, animal husbandry, buying and selling, and commerce. Fetishistic beliefs and the white magic described in this remarkable collection were sanctified on every occasion by sayings of the Shi'i Imams. Even more than mirroring popular practices of the late Safavid society, this book may be seen as an attempt of the ulama to restrain, if not entirely deny, human agency by means of ritualizing individuality at every turn. The Safavid state was the willing partner in promoting Majlisi's traditionalist doctrine. By the time of Shah Suleiman, Majlisi and a network of his protégés exercised great influence in the Safavid administration and on its policies. He himself was pampered as royalty, with tremendous wealth and luxury, extending, it was said, to many wives and slave concubines. Repeatedly denouncing the scholarship of his time for deviating toward philosophy at the expense of hadiths, he persuaded the Safavid rulers not only to forego the earlier patronage of philosophy and mysticism, but also to suppress signs of religious and social diversity. Among his many acts of reproof and refutation, Majlisi, following his father's lead, was responsible for active persecution of the Jewish, Zoroastrian, and Hindu communities in Isfahan and elsewhere, as well as for increasing intolerance toward remnants of Sunni communities, especially along the Iranian periphery. His anti-Jewish treatise, Zava'igel Yahud, Lightning Bolts on the Jews, which called for the imposition of numerous discriminatory measures against Jews, might be seen as a natural outcome of sporadic anti-Jewish persecution since the time of Abbas I. His call to destroy the image of a Hindu god in a temple in Isfahan belonging to the Indian commercial community, however, was a result of his studied intolerance toward non-Muslims. His anti-Sunni policies, moreover, had some effect on the rise of anti-Shi'i sentiments in the Iranian periphery, as in Kandahar, and on the Safavids' eventual downfall a quarter of a century after Majlisi's death. The cultural orientation of the Safavid ulama from Karaki, the leading 16th-century jurist from Jabalia Mil, to Majlisi, had hardly changed even after two centuries of Persianization. The sum total of the anti-intellectual drive behind a facade of madrasa learning can be summarized as obsession with the hadith, legal conservatism, ritualization of Shi'ism, rejecting diversity, and popularizing of a tearful myth of suffering of the Imams. their hostility toward Persian literary and artistic pursuits, and condescending attitude even toward their lay constituency, was typical of their socio-cultural orientation. The Iranian public reserved great ambivalence for the ulama, a sort of love-hate relationship, revering them for their hard-to-understand learning and for their sanctified posture, and despising them for their haughtiness, hypocrisy, and greed, all of which is highlighted vividly in Persian literature. Yet the ulama's inherent conservatism enjoyed the blessing of the Safavid rulers, from Tahmasp to Sultan Hussein, who consistently lavished them with praises and pensions. Vast endowments, or ghaf, that the Safavids devoted to religious learning, especially under Abbas I, made the ulama enormously rich, but also further subservient to the wishes of the state. There were occasional quarrels, for instance, about wine drinking and the patronage of such practices prohibited in Islam as music and painting, or about the deviant sexual habits of the royal family. But these were not serious enough to cause a refit between the religious establishment and its royal benefactor. A handful of jurists, Karaki included, did claim to be the deputy of the imam, Naeb-e imam, and viewed themselves as those who had invested political power in the Safavid ruler. The motives for the Safavids to abide by such pretensions may be traced in part to the religious zeal of rulers such as Tahmasp and Sultan Hussein. Their propensity for hyper-religiosity served as an incentive for greater acceptance of the ulama and their claim to authority. More so, it can be traced to the state's effort to preserve the jurist class as essentially separate from the rest of the society. The more the jurists were alienated from the public, including their inability to converse in proper Persian, the better the ulama could serve the Safavids' wishes. The collaboration proved enduring, following an ancient pattern of interdependence of the good government and the good religion. The ulama were bound to target the competing bad religion of the agnostics, the Galandars, the Sufi orders, the recluse mystics, the philosophers, the Sunnis, Jews, Zoroastrians, Christians, and, soon after, heathen Europeans. Any nonconformity was sinful, and therefore dangerous, particularly if it lapsed into neglect of devotional acts and fetishized practices. Ritual cleansing of the body, obsession with pollutants, and intricate rules of prayer and fasting, which in the jurist's view defined adherence to correct faith, controlled the public. The ulama thus served the state as moral police, defining learning, disciplining leisure, promoting uniformity, and sharpening the divide between the saved, Shi'i, and the damned other. Very late in the 17th century, there were converts who also helped reaffirm the Majlisi brand of conservatism. Padre Antonio de Jesus, the Portuguese head of the Augustinian monastery in Isfahan, who converted to Shi'ism in 1697 and adopted Ali Goli Jadid al-Islam as his new name, is a case in point. Among his many Persian language anti-Christian polemics, his Saif al-Mu'minin wa Qital al-Mushrikeen, the sword of believers and slaying of the polytheists, is a violent attack not only on Christians, Jews, and Sunnis, but also on philosophers, Sufis, and antinomians. This all-embracing refutation, rare though it was, epitomized obstacles to cross-cultural exchanges with a secularizing Europe. His appointment as the royal dragoman in the court of Shah Sultan Hussein further confirmed the state's patronage of a prevailing xenophobic tendency. Until the time of Majlisi, weapons of social control, even when fortified with the sanctity of the Hadith, were not fully in place. Leisure and artistic inspirations remained strong, at least strong enough to prompt jurists' lengthy and repeated condemnations of music and dancing, either for pleasure or at Sufi gatherings, wine drinking, which so frequently was portrayed in paintings of the period, women's venturing outside the harem, breaking of the recognized boundaries of sexuality, and above all, public disregard for norms of prescribed religion. Diffuse forms of nonconformity in public persisted and even thrived, despite the ascendancy of the pious. The tea and coffee houses, despite repeated denunciations by the jurists and physical onslaughts by seminarians, continued to be gathering places for poets and artists, and loci of artistic expression. Recitation of the Shahnameh by masterful storytellers, Nagals, continued to drive many believers away from mosques and from tragic tales of Shi'i suffering to their performances in public places and in coffeehouses. There they could listen to stories of Rostam's exploits in his seven trials, his fight with the white demon on Mount Damovand, or Nezami's romance of the Sasanian king Khosrow and Princess Shirin, the fair Christian ruler of Armenia. On a different level, the jurists' attack on philosophy and on organized and theoretical Sufism proved more effective. Philosophy, the most vulnerable of all, was banished to small and inconsequential circles at the margins of the madrasa. Even at its best, the energies of the school of Isfahan and Mullah Sadra's theosophy were never translated into a spirit of independent inquiry or any tangible investigation of human individuality so central to the modern self. Instead, the emphasis on the traditions of the imams, mostly invented by the likes of Majlisi into a nostalgic fantasy of pristine Islam, helped sapping whatever originality could have transpired from the new philosophical interest. The terse language and cryptic content of the philosophy of the school of Isfahan, a legacy of centuries of deliberate ambiguity designed to avoid orthodox criticism, naturally diminished its grasp by all but the closest adept. Later practitioners of Mullah Sadra's philosophy abandoned the most original and innovative in his discourse and clung to the most conventional and pious facets. Heretics like Mir Sharif Amoli, a Noctavi thinker of some originality, however, left the persecution of Safavid Iran behind for the relative security of Mughal India. This was the closest intellectual safe haven for many Iranian freethinkers. Mir Sharif thrived for a while in Akbar's court and was an important source of inspiration for aforementioned Abul Fazl Alami. Yet, like many of his Persian counterparts, Mir Sharif eventually ended up in a Sufi convent, leading the life of a mystic, uninterested in the affairs of the world. It was as if the only alternative to the madrasa's scholasticism was a mystic's convent, Khanegah, or as Hafez would have recommended, a tavern, Mekhaneh, for the skeptics disillusioned with organized Sufism. Yet both responses, as well as the Sharia-oriented philosophy of the late Safavid era, were unlikely candidates for the advent of any indigenous form of modernity. 17th-century Iran witnessed territorial consolidation, expansion of economy and communication, and the emergence of an impressive material culture. The state nurtured a class of jurists that advanced the cause of Shi'ism and, to a lesser extent, patronized speculative thought. The Safavid imperial model and its theory of legitimacy proved to endure long after the Safavids' demise. Most of these features were shared with contemporary Mughal India, Qing China, the Ottoman Empire, and Habsburg Spain. Yet, despite impressive achievements, in many respects the 17th century remained for Iran an age of unfulfilled potential. Neither Shah Abbas nor his successors were able to overcome the institutional limitations in the Safavid system. Weakening of the Gezilbash and its replacement with a Ghulam class did not end tribal conflict, which soon flared up spectacularly. The silk monopoly proved viable, but efforts to create an indigenous trading network competitive with the European trading companies was transient. The Safavids never developed a maritime empire and showed no interest in creating a naval power. Their overland territorial expansion paid off in the southern Caucasus and Persian Gulf, and less so in Iraq. But revenue from these sources was not a long-term remedy for the state's shortfall. Centralization of the agrarian regime raised revenue, but over the long term actually weakened Safavid defenses.